And just because I sound more perky than Renee this fine evening, it's the Agile Revolution. Hey, Renee.
Hello, perky Craig.
Well, when we were tossing a coin as to who was going to start, you said I sound a little more perky, so...
Sound way more perky than me at 10 to 10 at night.
Welcome along. It's Craig and Renee. No Tony. Missing in action. Didn't get the memo. Anyway, we're here. Time to talk all good things Agile. What's happening in the world, Renee?
So I'm going to start with some non-Agile stuff. Recently, I've just been really...
Non-Agile? You mean you're not going to talk about... Really, you're not going to talk about Lean...
No. I've really been enjoying getting feeds from Harvard Business Review. So if you don't have a look at what they produce, then please do take a look every now and then. But there's a couple that stood out to me recently. So one was around an article about time management training doesn't work, which
I saw that one.
Shouldn't be a surprise to people in the Lean Agile community. We've sort of known for a while that... due to the way in which we've got lots of context switching happening inside of the workplace, that something isn't quite right. But it was a really good article that, so it came out on April 22nd, that talked about the fact that the way that we used to do it from a time management perspective was, you know, having a to-do list, prioritizing them. But in essence, the way in which work now comes in quite... using electronic tools or people coming up and collaborating in open workspace sort of environments means that we're context switching more than ever. So it sort of gives some really good background around why this is an issue and then goes into some key elements that training should be focused on that really doesn't these days. So first thing being clarity around role priorities rather than specific task priorities. So that there's this idea around vision and that you're focusing on your roles, priorities, rather than necessarily everything that's coming through the side. Attention management skills rather than time management skills. So stick on to that task, stick on to what your role is meant to be doing rather than these extra things off to the side. And I think that's really quite interesting to me because I have had a number of discussions with people recently that say that they're finding it harder than ever to concentrate. And whether something about the way in which we're interacting with our mobile devices or our smartphones is causing us to be worse than ever in attention management. And then the last thing being a comprehensive workflow management system, which, you know, Agile definitely helps out with.
Oh, sorry, I was playing Angry Birds. I wasn't listening to a thing you said then, no, Renee. Look, do you remember doing time management training back in the day? I remember it was one of the,
yeah, I do.
I remember it was crap. One of those things in the 90s actually it was even before I actually got my first job. It was one of those, actually my I guess my internship or whatever you want to call it, and they decided that you know, as part of that it would be a good thing to send me to time management training. That was a day sat there where they taught me, you know, how to do things like file and put things into folders and Outlook and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I got to the end of it and went, geez, that's going to take me more time than to do than what I was doing before. So I got a feel for people who are coming into the workforce now. I mean, you know, there's just so many different information sources. Back when I started, you know, you couldn't even sort of find a machine that had the internet on it. So, you know, the only thing you had was a big binder, and finding the time to kind of, you know, leaf through that now, it's just unlimited.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you've got a reference in here. More than a quarter of the time someone switches tasks, it's 2 hours or more before they actually resume what they were doing. And I read that and I thought, nah. And then I started thinking about examples about my work. And aside from the pop-ups from Microsoft Mail, which is a really bad context switcher, so if you're listening, turn it off and just schedule time to read mail.
Have you done that?
No.
Yeah, I read these things all the time, and you know, I still have. You know, I can't do it. I can't do it. So I'm not telling anybody to turn up, pop off, because I just can't do it. I try to.
Hey, I'm getting through my work. It's okay.
I try to ignore them. I try to practice the inbox zero, but yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean,
do what we say, not what we do.
That's it. Agile. I mean, you should see how we put this podcast together. You know, it's waterfall all the way, people. But the two hours thing. I mean, I've heard that stat before. I mean, I know when you're changing tasks, you know, there is certain that ramp up, and certainly that ramp up time. But I don't know. Have you read the study behind that?
The Microsoft study? No. Have you?
No, I've heard this one mentioned numerous times. I mean, I know that, you know, the more times you multitask, you know, throughout the day, the more times you task switch, obviously, it's one of those things that, you know, when you have a kind of day where you get to the end of it and go, man, that was busy, and you can't think of what you did, you know, that's a good sign. You've been doing lots of multitasking. It doesn't mean that you actually haven't been doing something, but, you know, when you have a productive day, you know, that day you work from home, or, you know, that day where you just get into work and you go, look, I'm just going to concentrate on something, and the other days you kind of look back on and go, why can't they all be like that? You know, that's the focus of actually, you know, being focused on something. And even with teams, I see that actually, you know, properly practice work in progress limits. Not, you know, I've got a Kanban wall, but we threw away the
numbers
at the
top. Not lip service, yeah.
But you see that as well, because they're really focused on getting things done. So certainly that being focused thing. But,
yeah.
But just life is one of those things where, you know, where things take your, you know, you just need a phone call or something, I guess. And, you know, but I find it hard to believe it's 2 hours. But I do know after you take a phone call, you sit there and you go, oh, well, maybe I should write some notes about that, or, you know, oh, it's time for a coffee, or, you know, those things certainly do take your time away.
Definitely. So the study that it's referring to is called Disruption and Recovery of Computing Tasks, Field Study, Analysis and Directions.
Excellent. It's a page turner.
It was written.
So if anyone would like to read that for us and give us a free pricey, yeah, please email us at theagilerevolution.com.
So, of course, we're too busy context switching to read that, but that's side.
That's right. All right, we've done that one no justice. What else is coming out of the HBR?
There's been a couple of really good emotional intelligence ones also. So there's one around how to help someone develop emotional intelligence, which I know that you actually could.
What is emotional intelligence for those people that are listening and go, I'm a bit emotional and I've got intelligence. But yeah, how do you describe emotional intelligence?
Self-awareness, social skills, to be able to interact in a healthy way.
So in other words, not being Sheldon.
I think that would be an extreme, right?
Yeah, although he does know to give people a hot beverage, I guess. But anyway, Big Bang Theory people. Okay, but so helping someone to develop emotional intelligence.
Yeah, I didn't think it was actually possible. So that's what intrigued me about the article. It was talking about doing a number of really simple steps. So one, which was interesting because you talk about this, Craig, which is find the dream. So if you're not passionate about something particular, about a project, then you need to re-engage in some way. So the first comment was find the dream. Help them find or discover what's important in their life, and only then can you move on to aspects of work that are important to this person. Then find out what's really going on, what the state of their current emotional intelligence and the current environment is. And then obviously do a sort of like a gap analysis. They talk about thinking of it more like how do you create a learning plan to get there, rather than thinking of it as a performance management plan or development plan. So less around skills development, more around learning goals.
I'm struggling a little bit to find how that's emotional intelligence, though. Isn't that just finding your way? Is it by helping people get there that helps, that then that links on to developing emotional intelligence? Is that what they're trying to say?
Yes, so they talk initially around neurological pathways and it being in a means to be able to help establish and start growing those pathways. And only through constant regrowth of those pathways do we improve our emotional intelligence. So I think it's really more around how do you supercharge a brain that is stagnant?
Yeah, well, if you think about that, it's kind of common sense, really, is that you want people to be working on things that tickle their boxes, you know, the mastery, autonomy, and purpose type line. So it seems rather obvious in some respects, I guess. But
it's so easier said than done, because, you know, it's a great 15-minute RSA Animate video, but how do you actually apply it? So this is giving some really tangible, deeper dive into what to do, not necessarily step-by-step instructions, but a bit better than just motivate people.
I mean, when you sort of introduced the article, when you know, when I was thinking about when you're describing emotional intelligence, I mean, I even think of things like, you know, you've got kids, for example, and you know, part of your job as a parent is to, you know, to walk them through life to some respect, you know, what you know, the things that they're going to be looking out for when they grow up and those type of things. And if you think about that, that's what your job as a parent is to, you know, help them find their dream or the thing that they want to do and help them, you know, move towards it. When you're thinking about how emotional intelligence being, you know, how I kind of sit in a team and how I give something back, it, yeah, I mean, it's kind of obvious sitting from the outside, but you're right. It's I think the thing that's missing is for leaders, particularly, to be able to recognise when you know, people are falling down that path.
What about you, Craig? What do you got?
What do I got? Lots of little things, but this one is something I just read just recently and kind of tweaked my interest, because you know how much I am an XP fan. You know, that's where I started. You know, the Scrum thing's okay for if you want backlogs and all that kind of stuff, but if you really want to get stuff done, then extreme programming. And there's been a whole bunch of articles or, you know, discussion, I guess, on the forums about, you know, particularly Ron Jeffries, one of the founders, saying he wants his XP back. It's kind of, he wants to revive it. It's gone away, and you know, it did it really die? And it's something I've, you know, it's questions I've even asked some of the people on interviews on this on this podcast. You know, is XP actually dead? And what most people agree, including myself, is that it actually didn't really die. It just became software engineering good practice, or, you know, at least should have become software engineering good practice. This article by Benji Weber is what he calls modern extreme programming, because he was kind of reading this stuff by Ron Jeffries and sort of said, well, actually, it hasn't really died. There's lots of us actually doing this. It's just it's moved on a little bit, because XP was always about turning the dials to 11. So, you know, what he does is goes through some of the processes. For example, pair programming is now being more popularized as mob programming, which is Woody Zuhl's approach. Things like continuous deployment, you know, is now the extension to continuous integration. I mean, continuous integration, you know, that was 1990s.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that it was just mostly being renamed. It's almost like the Phoenix. It's not dead. It's re-risen under something else.
Re-risen, but I think improved. I always talk about the fact, as you know, the Agile Manifesto, I think, still holds true, because principle number 12 is, you know, continuous improvements at its heart. And so because of that, you know, that's why it hasn't really died away. So, yeah, continuous integration is still there. It's just it's just good practice. Mind you, I still see so many organizations that still don't do it, which scares me. But continuous deployment is now it. But you can't do continuous deployment without doing continuous integration. So it's not that it's been rewritten. It's just that we've found better ways of doing it. But the one that I thought was interesting was in XP, there was one called collective code ownership. Do you remember that one, Renee?
Mm.
Yeah, which was obviously about anyone on the team can improve any part of the system at any time. What he has suggested, and I thought this one was interesting, is that collective code ownership has now become collective product ownership.
And in what way?
So what he's basically saying is that what we need to do is extend collective ownership to all parts of the product development, which is not only the coding, but the product planning and the running in production, which, when you think about it, starts to include what we do as a product owner and when we do design thinking and those type of prospects, through to DevOps at the other end when we keep it, you know, running in production. So it's really the collective product ownership is really the answer to the water scrum fall problem. Collective code ownership was very, you know, that scrum part, you know, we're doing it quite well. Everybody on the team owns it. But once it gets to the other two sides, it kind of falls away. So I'm not entirely sure the name is quite right there, but it's an interesting prospect. I hadn't really thought of that one in that particular way before.
How is that different from the lean enterprise concept, you know, from Jez Humble's recent sort of perspective on that?
Same type of thing. In fact, you could probably call it that. You know, so his definition here is that everyone on the team should be not only free but encouraged to change any part of the code base, any part of the production infrastructure, discuss product direction with business decision makers.
Okay.
So.
And what about the metaphor? Is that dead?
The which? Sorry.
The metaphor.
Oh, the metaphor. Nobody ever understood the metaphor, so I think it just died. I love the metaphor. Where'd it go? He talks about, you know, now we've got products, not projects, which is something we've been talking about for a while. Test first or test driven development becomes monitor first development. So TDD becomes MDDD. So what that is
making.
MDDD. So this is really lean startup thinking, because what we're saying is that what we want to do is make sure that we have features that can be easily monitored. So, you know, and that makes sure that we're, you know, that we're doing good things. So it means that we can essentially get data from the things that people are using in production.
So measure-driven development.
Yes.
Well, right.
He calls it monitoring-driven development, but yes, it allows you to get the measure.
Yeah, I think I like measure better than monitor, but anyway.
Yeah, this is written by a programmer, so you've that was one of the problems with XP, is a few of them were too codey in their own right. He talks about you know, stories are good for conversations, but we need hypotheses or assumptions. So, you know, what this is really it's a team that's taken lean startup and applied it. But you know what this guy's kind of saying is, as he went back and actually had a look at XP, it hasn't gone away. It's actually the foundation of why we've been able to do a lot of these things moving forward.
What about CRC cards?
Well, did you ever use a CRC card?
I didn't hear many people talk about a couple of years ago, yes. Very similar to FTD's sort of concept as well. So, you know, people don't do design the way that they used to do it 10 years ago, and I think that's actually a little bit sad.
Well, there were some good things and some bad things. I mean, things like, you know, design thinking, I think, and you know, a lot of this lo-fi prototyping are extremely good. But I do agree that, you know, if you think about why Scrum was set up to have, you know, 2-week sprints, it was so you had that, and the fact that you were supposed to be able to cancel a sprint was so that you could actually, as a team, get in there and really think about the solution. And actual fact, it was also built as such that when you're in the early stages of perhaps a product development, you might actually even have 3 or 4 week sprints in order to deliver something to move forward. And that's something that's kind of got lost a little bit as we try to get faster and faster and faster and faster feedback loops.
Yeah, and in fact, I was looking at spikes and thinking exactly the same. I haven't heard of many spikes in the last few years because of a lot of the different enablers that we've had as we develop that sort of cut down the time in order to build. And so, you know, sometimes you can actually identify options and fulfill it inside of the story still with it inside of the iteration or the sprint. Anyway.
Yeah, the spike. Although I still see in a lot of places people doing 3-week spikes, which is also rather irritating. So there you go. What an extreme programming.
What else?
What else do I have? Well, we were both looking just before we came on air. This has been out for a little while, but the 9th annual State of Agile survey, the version 1 survey, has come out.
Yes, so I was taking like all of 2 minutes to rapidly read through it and go, what was different from last year? And there were a couple of things that actually stood out. So the thing that was really great to see was obviously the number of extremely knowledgeable people increasing, which is what you'd expect, you know, as we continue to go further across the chasm. You can imagine that's going to naturally happen. What about you?
Still a lot of people. Okay. There's still a lot of people at the bottom end, though. That's kind of surprising. I mean, that, you know, there is 28% and 30% in that top one, but still surprising how many people still have no knowledge or you know, very little knowledge for something that's been around for 15 years now.
That's understandable. We're still working across to get to that 100% mark, but interestingly, the number down below is the number of organisations that practice Agile is now at 94%.
Yeah, that was the one I was just looking at. Well, I wonder what that means.
I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah. The number of organisations that know how to spell Agile, 94%.
Well, it was more the number of organisations that respond to this survey.
The number of organisations, yeah, that respond to the survey that practice Agile is 94%. Yeah, I'm not sure there.
Yeah.
You know, have you heard of version 1? Yes. Right. Have you heard of Agile? No. Not sure that's really going to happen. Percentage of teams using Agile? You know, only 9% where all the teams are using Agile. So we've still got a long way to go.
Wow.
To get
there. Yeah.
You know, I would have thought, I would have probably hoped that some of the, I mean, a lot of these numbers are reasonably similar to what they were in previous years, but I would have hoped that maybe some of these had, you know, popped up. I mean, you know, 80% response have some distributed Agile going on, and that doesn't surprise me.
But that's significantly increased from 2 years ago, because that used to be 35%. And that somewhat scares me quite a bit, that there's either so much distribution out there, or that we think in some way that distributed Agile is an easy thing. It's so much so that we're doing it lots. I don't know how to take that.
Yeah, I think the devil's in the detail on that one. But yeah, you're right. What does distributed actually mean? Does it mean that there's actually physically a team somewhere else, or does that just mean that people are working a 3-day week?
Mm.
They've got the improvements from implementing Agile. So the big one is the ability to manage changing priorities. Yeah, so no surprises there. Increased team productivity, improved project feasibility, increased team morale and motivation. 79% got better.
Yeah, it's always been up there in previous years, that one.
Then sort of all the way down to, yeah. And then better managing distributed teams is the one that's lower, still 59%, but quite lower. Scrum is still a predominant practice, 56%, although that number's down.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is they haven't mentioned any of the new players on the field. So whilst we do have Kanban and Scrumban, which I think Scrumban was there, I'm not quite sure, last year. But nothing from the scaling sort of area. So custom hybrid is there, but no safe, no less. Lean development's there. And despite your comments about XP, less than 1% of people are doing that.
That's right. Well, although Scrum XP hybrid's at 10%, so I think that's where most people would probably put themselves.
Still 11% is pretty shocking.
Yes. Well, compared to 56% of Scrum. Top 5 Agile techniques, the number one technique again for this year is, Renee,
daily stand-up.
Yep, so easy to do, so easy to screw up. And short iterations, prioritise backlogs, iteration planning, and retrospectives. Yeah, looking, I guess, further down, though, at some of the other ones that are in there, BDD, behaviour development, only 9% of teams. I mean, that's something that's been around for a little while. That number's actually a little higher than maps I maybe would have thought it would have been, especially when you compare it to some of the numbers above in the techniques, though.
4% lower than Agile Games.
Yeah, well, what does that mean, I guess? 21% pair programming, that number's actually, again, quite high. I'm not sure what that means. I wonder whether there's a lot of people answering the query goes, yeah, there's two guys sitting over there, they're probably pair programming, and tick the box. Continuous deployment maybe. Only is at 24%. And continuous integration is still at 50%. I mean, we were just talking about it earlier, right? What are the other 50% of people doing if they're not doing continuous integration, really? You know, team-based estimation, 56%. You know, that's really saying that 44% of people rely on one dude in the corner to do estimation for them, or hopefully no estimates. But I'm not entirely sure that number is going to be 44%. 65% people doing unit testing. Right? What are the other 45% doing? Right? Hoping it works.
And you're not saying why the other 20% doing if they're not doing a daily stand-up?
I don't want to talk about it.
Or if they're not continuously improving through retrospectives, 31% are not doing retros.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me. You know as well as I do the amount of organisations we go into, Renee, right? The amount of people who throw retrospectives out. I think that number's high, honestly. Right? If that actually said who's doing good retrospectives, I think that number would go down.
Well, luckily it doesn't ask the question for any of these, are you doing good?
That's right. Are you doing good coding standards? 43%. What else we got in here? The barriers to add to further Agile adoption. Organisational culture is still a big one, 44%.
Yep.
Resistance to change. 34%.
Management support. Yeah. Yep.
Pre-existing rigid waterfall framework, 32%.
Ah, awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny, interesting, there's nothing in there about governance process, because maybe they think pre-existing waterfall framework equals governance. It's intriguing.
I mean, regulatory compliance is in there, but that's obviously more specific. Yeah, 15% confidence in methods for scaling Agile. That's an interesting one.
What about a sponsor? I can't even see anything about a sponsor in there.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, you are right. How do we measure success? So on-time delivery is number one. Yeah, I thought that was always what we measured success on. Getting it on time.
Software is the primary measure of progress.
That's exactly it. Product quality, 48%. Customer satisfaction, 44%. Business value, 44%. Yeah, product scope, features and requirements, 39%. That one kind of worries me, but that still smacks a little bit of traditionalist approach that, we have to have everything. You know, whilst I understand there's still lots of products where that is important, that number seems a bit high to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
11% on don't know.
And then how you measure success on a day-to-day basis? All right, and everybody's favourite V word at 59%. Velocity burndowns, iteration and release are still the ways people measure success. In fact, you have to go down to number 7 at 28%, which is customer user satisfaction.
Mm. I've found it really intriguing that they've actually got number 5 as a burn-up chart there. So they've got an iteration burn-in and a release burn-down, and then 5 as a burn-up.
Yeah, I think that's probably showing the 58% of Scrum showing through a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There is a scaling agile in here as we flip back through. So, which they've had in there before, and still, most people scale via Scrum of Scrums. 25% internally created methods. I'd like to know what some of those are. But there's your scale ladder framework at 19%.
25% of people, you are awesome. Sorry, just had to put it out there.
And then we've got Enterprise Agile, Enterprise Scrum, Agile Portfolio Management, DAD, 4%. So that's IBM, I guess. Large-scale Scrum at 3%. the RAGE, Agile Governments in the Enterprise at 1%. So there you go. Project Management Tools.
That is a huge jump last year, though, isn't it?
The Scrum of Scrums was always at the top there, but I think SAFE has certainly jumped. I'll have to go back and look. If I was more prepared for this podcast, I probably would have gone and had a look at that. Interestingly, though, project management tools, at 68%, the most used project tool is 68% is Microsoft Excel. 46% Microsoft Project. What the heck? The question is use of agile project management tools. Not project management tools, agile project management tools. Jira comes in at 45 and not, understandably, version 1 comes in at 33. And it kind of goes down from there.
Cool.
And obviously Satisfaction, version 1, comes in at 92%. But again, not surprising, given version 1 run the survey. Although I did speak to Robert Holler, the CEO of version 1. He actually said that was something they were actually quite surprised about. I mean, because Atlassian comes in at 86%. I mean, a lot of people love Atlassian, and LeanKit, which is the other one that people really, really love, came in quite high. But, he was actually...
My favourite one isn't actually in there. Is Trello.
Well, yes, not even asked about, is it? I mean, you've got Vendor Y. You got Vendor Y and Vendor X. So you know one of those is Rally.
Mm. So why is Atlassian Jira not blanked out then?
Because certain vendors, from my understanding, asked not to be mentioned.
Right. Okay.
I remember that from years ago.
So does this actually suggest to you that people are using version 1 and Jira or version 1 and Rally? Is that possible? Multiple tools, one place?
In the early days, I used to see a lot of that. I think that's going away a little bit, particularly with scaling frameworks now. But I still come across organizations that have multiple.
Version 1, listening, ask next time if people are using multiple. That'd be good to know.
Well, it says here that vendors X and Y requests not to be identified. Respondents were able to make multiple selections, so it's feasible.
Mm.
And I suspect Definitely. And I suspect that's why Excel has come out so big, because they see Excel in there and they go, yeah, I use Excel to produce my burn-up chart or something. So
exactly.
So they're gonna click it. When you take it away, it really does start to show that Jira is still the really the predominant product out there, which kind of matches, I think, with what I hear. And in this case, version 1, which, if you consider the US market, is probably not too far away. TFS at number 3.
Yeah, I was going to say the predominant, according to the survey, is version 1.
Yeah. So, interesting. Anyway, State of Agile with it's good just to have a bit of a scroll through it and have a bit of a discussion about things, really. That's... you get nothing else from it.
Hmm. So there's a recent blog post around SAFE. Do you want to keep talking about SAFE? Do you just want to move on from it?
Oh, well, I'm happy to talk about SAFE if you'd like to talk about SAFE.
So it's by Mike Cottomea.
I think they're on SAFE, though, and it's something, you regardless of what you think of it, it's there. We've got to respect it, and because it's there. So I still think the conversations where we can look to talk about where it can be improved, but balancing that with some of the things it brings to the table that are quite good, other things we should be talking about.
So I think with relevance, the topic of this particular blog post is let's acknowledge SAFe for what it is and move on.
There you go. I hadn't read that, but did I just paraphrase his whole article?
Well, a little bit, but it was more around, it was going into the background of why Agile came to be and how it was a lightweight framework and the sort of things that we were trying to achieve out of it, such as autonomous teams and, you know, having good tests, you know, making changes in a safe way. And then he goes into talking about the fact that, let's be clear, most organizations can't form teams that have tightly coupled non-autonomous teams that have a lot of organizations have poor alignment to the business. They have
good
teams
tests,
that are still in structure. They don't.
They're not safe to make changes. They're staffed as matrices. He's got this whole list in there. It's quite funny. You kind of look through it and you go, yep, that's right. And yep, don't disagree with you there.
Yep. So really, it's sort of like big enterprise unwilling to bend and shift. And what he's saying is that, look, if you want to do agile, then SAFe may be a good alternative in these organizations that are less than willing to shift because it's probably better than what they've already got. And it's still a step in the right direction. You can still get some benefits out of it by taking that approach. So, you know, acknowledge it for what it gives to organizations that don't want to go full hog into crazy agile land and just want to do the easier approach.
So is the problem that it's called the Scaled Agile Framework then? If it was called the Scaling Framework, would that be a better, or even if it was called this, you know, a bit like, you know, how we've got large scale Scrum, you know, is the word Agile in there perhaps the thing that causes
Well, I think in fairness, SAFe does have scaling elements in it that makes it quite useful. So I think the scale bit's right.
I guess
you could question the Agile bit, and I think a lot of the values and the principles that it talks about aren't just lean values and principles, they're also agile ones as well. So I think it's fair to call it a scaled agile framework. It's just, to me, I mean, you know, we've already talked about this before, it reminds me of something quite heavyweight. And I do think that organizations feel, sorry for the pun, SAFe, to use SAFe because they're more familiar with the structure and the rigor that it gives, and they feel that that structure and rigor would reduce some of the risk of, you know, the severe change that it could have to the organization.
Yeah, I think
it's sort of like we want to do agile but we don't want to be agile.
Well, yeah, I was recently talking to an agile coach in a large corporate just recently that's undertaking both a SAFe and an agile approach. They actually train people on both. And I really like the way they're approaching it. They're using SAFe as the change piece because they realize that what they were doing, so what they want to get out of is this agile versus waterfall thing. So now what they have is they essentially have this fast process, which is really their agile, which is really working well in their digital areas and places where they really have the game. And for everybody else, the move is toward is the more SAFe approach. So they can scale on big ticket, big vendor applications, where whilst you can't apply agile to it, and whilst they are actually proposing to do that, it's at least getting them out of the some of the old processes and giving them some of the values. And I think that's a really, as long as you realise that that's what it is, and this is what Mike's really saying here, is as long as you understand what it is, that's fine. What concerns me is that people follow the book by the letter and say, hey, we're agile. But the thing is, and I want to be very clear here, is that that's no different to me picking up the Scrum book and going, I've done that, now I'm agile, or picking up even the Kanban book and going, hey, I'm agile, because none of those things are agile in their own right.
But interestingly, to be fair, if you do some of these things and get better outcomes, then you're shifting more towards agility. It's just that you need to keep that momentum going.
Exactly.
You need to keep that Kaizen and that continuous improvement going.
Exactly.
So I think, I'm happy to call it an agile framework. It's just the importance here is that there's a continual focus on next steps. Where do we go next? How can we get better?
Yeah, and so, yeah, the safe ever place, I mean, as I say, it's there. It certainly does, and, you know, perhaps is bringing some larger corporates along for the journey that may not have, you know, taken that leap in the past. Mm. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
What will be a bad thing is that that SAFE itself doesn't continue to evolve, which the evidence shows that it actually is. You know, it has evolved. I mean, they're already version 3, and you know, versions coming all along. So it's self-evolving, and
it's evolving faster than Scrum is. Yeah,
exactly. And if the Agile community is actually, you know, if we actually take this passion, what we'll do is we'll start to actually come up with better ones. So, you know, you've got Baz Vodi out there who's, you know, rolled out, you know, less and less huge. And, you know, there's about 6 or 7 different scaling frameworks that there were people at least trying stuff and throwing it out there. And what we'll find is that, you know, it'll begin to stick and, you know, move forward. The thing it's got in its favour is that it's reasonably easy to understand, which is for all the same reasons why Scrum was successful. And I think that's where it's done its job extremely well.
Yeah, and I think going back to that version 1 sort of survey and why I was so happy about organisations that were doing their own thing, it's because, you know, you're doing that critical assessment about what's your current culture and what will work and what won't work and how can we move that needle onwards. And part of that to me is really understanding all the different frameworks that are out there and being able to make some sensible judgment decisions in order to do that. So it's not about choosing this one and only one process. It's more around understanding the family of agile goodness and what works.
Indeed. Very good. One last thing I wanted to talk about. This is something that I had heard about and probably hadn't paid much attention to it, but have you seen the Reactive Manifesto?
No. So, I get the feeling I'm about to hear about it, though.
Well, I think this is interesting. This has been around for a while. It's in version 2 now, so unlike other manifestos, it actually gets updated. And this is a little programmer, you know, focused, I guess. The Reactive Manifesto is essentially one of the things I think we found is, you know, since the Agile Manifesto was at a time where, you know, we were building systems, they were still, you know, the internet was still only reasonably new. You know, we kind of knew the kinds of things we were building, and so that kind of made sense at that particular time. One of the things that started to come out in the last, you know, 3 to 5 years now is the rules have changed. The cloud has changed things, always on internet has changed things, Wi-Fi has changed things, technology has changed things, mobile has changed things. And so the Reactive Manifesto is something that's been, you know, hitting around in the developer space for quite a while. And it's something I think I'd actually seen, but hadn't paid a lot of attention to. And I was at a meetup just recently where someone had gone into detail about this. So, you know, essentially what they're saying is that, you know, whilst Agile was important, which was about, you know, how we build things, we've now got to get back to, you know, building, you know, good software. And so essentially it's very simple. It's just, you know, it's a definition of what a reactive system is. So a reactive system is something that's always responsive. So a system always responds in a timely manner if possible. It's a system that's resilient, so it stays responsive in the face of failure. And if you think of things like Netflix, you know, as an example, Facebook, they've done very good jobs of making that happen. The system's elastic.
Sorry, Craig, mm-hmm. Can I just ask, when it says system, does it mean an IT system or a system as in systems thinking system?
It's in an IT system, so this is purely okay. a development development framework. So it's about developing systems that are responsive, resilient, elastic, which means it means it can respond to different workloads, and it's message driven, which means you know, there's been a lot of talk in the community about microservices, for example. This is one of the things that allows microservices to work because you can, you know, pass messages between things. So I guess the reason I just wanted to bring this up is it's interesting that you know, there's sometimes been some criticism by some of the early founders of the Agile Manifesto that, you know, Agile's kind of gone too process driven, and in a lot of cases they are correct. You know, we have put a lot of focus on it because that's an extremely important part of the process, but it's nice to see that the software development community are still actually moving forward. And, you know, there's lots of things like craftsmanship, and we talked about the, Modern XP before. The Reactive Manifesto is just another one of those things that's floating out there, and well worth a look if you're working with a development team or haven't seen it.
I think it's quite intriguing to me to start thinking about the system as in not necessarily an IT system and read that in the context of it being a system of people trying to get an outcome. And I think, you know, to me what's intriguing is, should a team be responsive, potentially? Should they be resilient?
Responsive to change, work with responsive to the customer.
Yeah.
You know, resilient, that's all things like sustainable pace, being able to
handling failure,
deal with blockers, particularly if you're doing something like Kanban, elastic, obviously when things get thrown into the system that you can respond to them, and message driven is really the scaling thing, right? It's small disparate teams that can work together, which if you think about the Spotify model, that's exactly what the Spotify model is. It's a it's essentially a bunch of message driven teams, so to speak. So yes, you can. While I was answering your question in relation to, it's written purely with programming in mind. Absolutely, it's probably a more modern look at the problems that we deal with in a modern organization.
All right, so I'm just going to go and buy the domain humanreactivemanifesto.org, and I'll get back to you.
Excellent. You really need to buy that, because someone who's listening is now going to buy it, right? If you haven't already done it by the time. Luckily, it takes us about 6 months.
Go for it, listeners.
It takes about 6 months to put the podcast up. So, anyway, interesting. Any tweets?
So there was an interesting tweet that was referring to a keynote that Michael Cohen did, which was, I think, it done in April around hindsight bias. And it was referring to a comment that he made inside of the presentation, which was just after he'd been talking about estimates, which was saying pages 238 to 40 of his Agile Estimating and Planning book,
in front of me here, Renee. You can see that. There it is.
And more are wrong.
Page 238, communicating about plans. Do I have the right version of this book?
You sure it wasn't the Gantt chart bit? Yeah, it probably may not be the right version of the book, because you've got one older than the actual published date. Is that right?
No, the bookmark in there is older than the. So I was telling when I was finding this book, it came out, and I opened the book up. I found a ticket, a flight ticket. What do you call it? Boarding pass. That's what word I'm looking for. A Qantas boarding pass, which actually has a 2005 competition on the back of it. So. Yeah, it goes to show that I've been reading Agile books a long time. If you're talking about page 238, figure 21.1, showing iteration contents in a Gantt chart. Each feature is shown to take the full length of the iteration into which it is scheduled. A feature may be done midway through an iteration, but it is not available to the organization until the end of the iteration, so that is what the Gantt chart reflects. No resource allocations are shown, because the whole team is responsible for delivery of features. There's no benefit in putting Mary's name next to one feature and Vadim's next to another.
Okay, so... not having seen the presentation, I'm actually quite curious about which bits he's referring to as potentially being wrong. But I think what's really awesome is, in hindsight, he's saying, look, some of the stuff isn't quite right. And I think anyone in the Agile community, especially thought leaders who step and say, got it wrong, I've learnt more from now, I think kudos to them.
Yeah, I mean, this whole section is about communicating the plan. So what does it say here? Well, what is shown is a feature breakdown structure rather than a work breakdown structure. Because it is the completion of features rather than the completion of the tasks that add up to a feature, that adds value to a product. The Gantt chart is drawn showing features.
So, I think maybe he just doesn't like Gantt chart. I don't know.
Page 239 is communicating progress using... He's got a sort of an iteration with the mean and the mean and the worst three iterations and the mean of the last eight iterations to be able to tell you about velocity. So measures of velocity are imprecise, and we expect velocity to fluctuate. The team has determined their average velocity is 10. It's not inconceivable that average is 9 or 11 for the next few iterations. Well, maybe that's what's incorrect, because if it's 10, it could be 3 or 27.
Or maybe we've moved on with no estimates.
Maybe we have. I mean, this book was written in 2006, so I think sometimes we I guess the thing is that, you know, whether Mike is still, I guess, you know, hanging on to everything that's in this book. I mean, there's something, if you're still doing velocity-based iterations, you know, there's a lot of stuff still in here. I mean, page 240, you know, how to figure out your velocity, right? You need to have three values: the velocity of the most recent iteration, the average mean velocity, the average mean velocity of the three slowest iterations. Anyway, that's page 230. That's a summary of page 238 to 240 of the book, Renee.
Well, I think the good news is he isn't beholden to that book permanently and is acknowledging that he's moving on.
Yeah. However, what I don't agree with him on is page 152, split user stories into tasks.
I think you might be on a losing battle with a lot of listeners on that one, Craig. I'm not disagreeing, but you might be a losing battle on that one. Any tweets for you?
Don't split them into tasks.
Put it away. Put the book away. Step away from the book.
Ask for a team commitment. Anyway, talking about estimates. This was one by Nozomi Ronin, this is Estimates in Classic Comedy. So you can imagine, if you've ever seen the movie Flying High, you've got essentially the doctor.
No, I'm too young for that.
Yeah, you can't remember Cheers either, right? Television show Cheers, really. Anyway, if you've ever seen Flying High, there's the doctor played by Leslie Nielsen, and there's Captain Over. And so the doctor comes into the flight deck and he goes, "Captain, these passengers don't have much time. How soon can we land?" Captain Over says, "I can't tell." He says, "You can tell me. I'm a doctor." He goes, What I mean is, I don't know." "Well, can't you take a guess?" "Not for another 2 hours." "You mean you can't take a guess for another 2 hours?" "No, what I'm saying is we can't land for another 2 hours." That's no estimates, in a nutshell. People misinterpreting the numbers. Anyway, no estimates in classic comedy. That's the tweet. What are you reading at the moment, Renee?
Well, actually, that is slightly interesting. And my backlog does continue to get longer and longer. But I did start, and I can't believe we just ended that on a no estimates. But I've been starting to read the beta book for No Estimates by Vasco Duarte.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage other people to read and provide feedback as he's progressing with the book, as always.
Yeah, and that's just on his website, isn't it, from memory?
Yeah. Can't even remember how I got it anymore, but yes, something like that.
We'll publish a link to where you can find some more information about that. I did mention this in the last podcast, but we had a couple that went in the can. So the book I have just finished is BDD in Action by John Ferguson Smart. Just been writing some reviews and things around that book, so that one's quite interesting. Books I'm just about to pick up, I've got a pile of them on my desk here, but you read this book recently, but something that's coming to ours, I'm just about to start Turn the Ship Around by David Marquette. So you've read that book, Renee. What are your thoughts on that one?
So I didn't read it. I listened to it on audible.com as my free book, and it was awesome to listen to, by the way. It was just a really good book around leadership, new age leadership, enabling autonomous teams, and the framework in which he undertook to do this. So that the gist of the book is that he went onto a submarine vessel. This was quite a while ago, I think back in the 90s, and it was the worst performing submarine in the fleet, and he turned it around to be one of the best performing ships in the fleet, hence the name Turn the Ship Around. And sort of he walks through what the environment was like, the things that he took to get there. And it even, you know, called out that it was very much he was in the right place at the right time, and that in a lot of cases, if he tried to do this on any ship, it would have failed. It was just because of the fact that this group of people had been beaten down so much, they had no other choice. So their call to action was huge.
Excellent. So you just saved me 180 pages, right?
But there's a really good quote in there around, you know, a small change to the rudder far out is a lot more effective than a significant change to the rudder up close, which is interesting when you think about it from a change management perspective. But
yeah. Anyway, on that note, Renee, if you want to know more, where they find you.
Okay. They can contact me, Renee, at theagilerevolution.com.
And I'm Craig at theagilerevolution.com. Until next time,
Viva la Revolution!